Russ Baker with us. We're going to get deep into this with your questions as we talk about the Kennedy assassination and some other issues next on Coast to Coast Day Out. Welcome back. Russ Baker with us. We'll get to your calls in a second as well. Russ, would you be considered a conspiracy theorist or not?
You know, I was fascinated with the use of that term when it was first presented to me. And so I dug into it a little bit, and what I discovered was that in the 1960s, the Central Intelligence Agency put out a memo advising that all of its media assets were to use that term. I'm not referring to you, George, but were to use that term in attempting to discourage discussion of the Kennedy assassination.
How about that? What are you working on next these days, by the way?
Sorry?
What are your new projects? What are you working on these days?
Well, I'm working on a book about the Kennedy assassination. That's a major focus of my time. But my so-called day job is running our news website, Who, What, Why. We are looking into these kinds of things on a real-time basis. We're looking at what's happening with, what is ISIS? You know, what's happening with these breaches of the White House, failures by the Secret Service? You know, these themes just continue to recur, these patterns, these networks. This stuff never goes away, and we think it's urgently important that some news organizations stay on top of this game and try to figure out what is happening to us, what's happening to our country, what's happening to the world. How do these things all relate to each other? We think it's important.
Are we losing grips of the country?
Well, I think the more I ponder the Kennedy assassination, what happened, the more I conclude that in 1963, we really saw some kind of a military coup, although it was bigger than the military. The removal of the president, and essentially the kind of the end of democracy in this country. And I think that when you ask, are we losing grip? I think we already lost grip. And I agree with the sentiment there that things are getting worse. And one of the things that troubles me deeply is how few Americans seem to be aware of this and how few seem to care. It's certainly not something that you hear in ordinary conversation. There does not seem to be an awareness or a concern that we may be plunging ourselves into some kind of profound darkness. And when you plunge yourself too deep, you just can't emerge from it.
Jim Garrison, what did you think of his work?
Well, you know, it's interesting because he was another figure who's been caricatured and demonized. And the more you look at what he did, the more you realize that he was something of an American hero, flawed to be sure, just as the Kennedys were, but also doing some fairly bold, important work that he was about it. You know, people like Garrison and Mark Lane and so on were among the few who were really willing to risk their careers and perhaps their lives to get to the bottom of this. And so much of Garrison's work was very, very important. We now know that Clay Shaw, the man that Garrison prosecuted in the Kennedy assassination, that Clay Shaw actually did have a relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency. We've found documents that prove that. And now I'm unearthing evidence that Clay Shaw was connected to an important person at Life Magazine. Life Magazine, the publication that choreographed the official story through the pages of this magazine that everybody read. So we are seeing in retrospect that the people we were told were bad were essentially good. The people we were told were good were essentially bad.
Let's take some calls here. We'll go east first. Pat in Minneapolis. Hey, Pat, go ahead.
In a book that she wrote, Kitty Kelly described how the real strong wall of protection that was around Kennedy because of his friendship with Sinatra was destroyed. And the way that happened, according to her, was when Kennedy White House was going to take their big trip to the West Coast, Sinatra had knocked out a tennis court and a pool for the presidential helicopter to land at his place, and it was going to be a great big deal with all of the, you know, the old friends and everybody. But Hoover cleverly said, well, you can't be there because of the mob connections. You're going to have to go to Bing Crosby's place. And that's what Kennedy unfortunately did. And he and Sinatra never again spoke. But I think that was one of the many ways that Hoover advanced his plot, pulled in CIA people because he knew they hated Kennedy, and mob people, they knew they hated Bobby for deporting old mobsters to Italy, etc.
What's your take on that, Russ?
Well, I can't comment to the particulars that she expressed, but I think that there is no question that Hoover's behavior vis-a-vis the mob is very, very important. As I mentioned earlier, the FBI, like all of or most of law enforcement, had an important informant relationship. They had an important relationship with people high up in criminal enterprises, and so they one of the things Hoover did was to basically try to claim that there was no such thing as organized crime, and he continued to do that for a long time. Bobby Kennedy, on the other hand, was extremely aggressive, and I mean extremely aggressive, in going after criminals of all kinds, whether it was so-called organized crime or was people at the corporate level who were guilty of corrupting this country. So certainly that factored in.
Up next, we go to Bob in Chicago on the wild card line. Bob, go ahead.
Oh, thanks, George.
Sure.
Yes, sir, I would like to know, there was a woman who said she saw an individual, a male subject, leave the back of the building there where the shooting occurred, supposedly occurred. And it looked like he had been carrying a rifle. And then when she talked to the officials on the scene, according to them, he did not fit the description of Oswell. You know anything about that? This other individual that this woman saw leaving the building, this depository with what appeared to be a rifle? He fled the building at a fast rate of, to get out of there, according to her.
Yeah. Yes, I have heard that. There also were sightings of people taking rifles apart up near the railroad bridge, Grassy Knoll, of people near a broken-down truck, possibly with a rifle there. There were a whole number of sightings, and there's very little evidence that there was any attempt by investigators to follow any of those things up. And by the way, the notion of Oswald going out the front door and somebody else going out the back door fits what we call the two Oswald scenario. There are very strong indications that they had one and possibly multiple people who looked quite a bit like Oswald playing a dual role. For example, a man who went to test drive a car out of an auto dealership, and he said very loudly, "My name is Lee Harvey Oswald," and then he drove like a maniac. We know that Lee Harvey Oswald did not know how to drive a car. So this appears to be evidence of this plot to have other people pretending to be Oswald doing all sorts of things that were going to create an impression of a maniac.
What, for you, Russ, is probably the most sensational aspect of the Kennedy assassination?
Boy, George, that's a tough one. You know, this is, it's a story that itself is so sensational. And as I look at pieces of it, I continue to find it to be really one of the most amazing stories ever told. Boy, if I had to pick something, what would I think was so amazing? I mean, I suppose it would be the synchronicity in the case. It would be the incredible number of coincidences. Let me give you an example. Several years earlier, a group of men went into a truck dealership in Louisiana and they said they wanted to buy a bunch of trucks, as I recall. That was the they were saying something about Cuba, using them for Cuba. According to the people who worked at the car dealership, one of them said, "My name is Lee Harvey Oswald." Now, this is probably, we think this is before the plot against Kennedy was ever hatched, and this was when Lee Harvey Oswald was living in the Soviet Union at the time. Now, how could it be that so early there were people already attempting to put his name out there and to make him out to be something that he was not? My conclusion from that, and I'm still thinking about it, is that Oswald may have been an extremely important intelligence asset, extremely important, that they were setting him up to do some very, very important things with Cuba, with the Soviet Union, and that the Kennedy plot was basically grafted onto it late in the game.
Yeah, I think you're right, and unbeknownst to him. I think when he came out of that police office and said, "I'm a patsy," he truly was.
That's right. He truly was, and this is a man. I think that the tragedy there is that Lee Harvey Oswald probably was a great American patriot. Now, that will seem like a splash of cold water in some people's faces, but I think the point is that this is a young man who came from a difficult background and who managed actually to excel. I mean, according to Marina and other people, when they met him in the Soviet Union, they thought that he was from some part of the Soviet Union because he spoke such excellent Russian. And the question would emerge, how does a Marine who that was not his language, how does he speak Russian so well? I mean, this was a fellow who apparently, he appears to have excelled on so many different levels. My belief at this point is that he was some kind of a covert officer in the U.S., in that he was serving what he thought was his country. And so at the 11th hour, when they were willing to throw him to the wolves, I think that would just dawned on him that, you know what, even I'm expendable, and all of this stuff I was told about serving your country means absolutely nothing.
And I would guess, Russ, that they had Oswald picked out way before the assassination occurred, which they probably planned shortly after Kennedy got elected.
I mean, I think it's entirely possible. We do know that, you know, I mean, one of the other frustrations about the establishment treatment of all of these stories is, let's say, the story that Kennedy was a hawk, you know, that he wanted these wars and so on. The truth of the matter is, the more you drill down, what you find out is that John F. Kennedy, going all the way back almost a decade before he was president, during his time in the U.S. Senate particularly, that he was very much an advocate of what you'd call the third way. He recognized that the world was being bifurcated between the West and the Soviet bloc, and that some of these other countries, places like Laos and Indonesia and so forth, might need to go their own way, what they call the third way. And as a senator, he was one of the most outspoken people about that. And so he would have been seen as a radical and a troublemaker right from the get-go. I think there was a sense that because his father was quite conservative, that the father would make sure that the son would not do too much as president. And I think that you're quite correct, George, that right out of the gate, there were already indications internally, at least, and through certainly many of his actions and many of his speeches, that he was really a whole bold new thing for a president, and that this was going to be a problem, particularly for the so-called military-industrial complex that Eisenhower had just warned us about, and for the large corporations that were increasingly dominating the country and the global economy.
Yeah, all the other previous presidents played the game, and you know, they were faced with a Kennedy who didn't want to play the game, and I don't think they could take it. They couldn't handle it, Russ.
Well, that's true, and I think it's important to remember that going back well before Kennedy, although they all played the game to some extent, a number of the presidents were assassinated, again, by purported lone kooks. A number of them attempted to assert their independence with some difficulty. And if you look at Franklin Roosevelt, then there are several books on this. There was the planning of a coup, so-called Wall Street coup, where Wall Street bankers decided that his post-Depression strategy was too socialistic, a term that's also used, by the way, to handicap Obama in the few areas where he tries to do something independent, and that there was an effort to recruit the military to overthrow FDR.
Next up, we go to Ryan in the state of Washington. Hey, Ryan, thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just keep this quick. Can you explain the magic bullet theory real quick? And could Kennedy have been potentially assassinated because he may have been going to reveal the truth about Roswell? And I'll just take the answer up the air. You guys have a good night.
All right, sure thing. The magic bullet theory first, Russ.
Yeah, I mean, that entered late in the game. It's very, very interesting to note that the FBI report, which was the original document on this, did not match with the Warren Commission's, because the FBI basically claimed that there were three shots. They all hit. Two hit Kennedy and one hit Connally. And then what happened was they discovered the so-called TAG bullet, that a bullet had hit a curb and missed entirely, took a chunk out of the curb, and then the shrapnel hit Mr. Tague. This was confirmed, and there was no question about that. And so you had one bullet there. Now you had a problem that they, with the three shells found on the sixth floor, and the amount of time, number of bullets that could have been fired, and the amount of time as determined by the Zapruder film, there could have only been two other shots. And because Kennedy was hit by two shots and Connally was hit by one, they had to say that one of the shots that hit Kennedy was the same one that also hit Connally. And that is where, very late in the game, not too long before the Warren Commission was wrapping up, member of the staff, Arlen Specter, who went on to become a U.S. senator, hatched this so-called single bullet or magic bullet theory, that this bullet somehow went through Kennedy, it hit Connally in several different places. It seems medically and scientifically to be virtually impossible. Also, that same bullet was then said to be found to be pristine after all of that damage. So that is the magic bullet thing. On as far as the other part of that, I don't know anything about that.
No. Well, always talked that Kennedy knew something about UFOs or us, and he was going to release it, but who knows? Who knows? Relationship with Marilyn Monroe. Real?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I haven't gotten that much into it. I had dinner the other night with a famous person who's written books on these things. He's quite convinced that Kennedy was extremely active, from his research, extremely active in the, shall we say, in the dating
in the
scene
in the boudoir
while he was president.
Yeah, he sure was. So was his brother.
You know, it's interesting to me that so much interest is focused on those things. And I understand why those are tantalizing and are interesting, but unfortunately, we've got only so much bandwidth. We've only got so much time, and I prefer to focus on the questions of what happened to America under him, what happened as a result of the coup. Those seem to be much more crucial to ourselves and to our future as a country.
Back with final questions next on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with some incredible stories, so don't miss that. And we'll come back with final phone calls with Russ Baker right here on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back with you in our final segment with Russ Baker, and we'll take your calls as well. Russ, thorough job about the family of secrets, and I would predict that you'll equally be thorough with your Kennedy work when it comes out.
Well, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to once again documenting in tremendous detail, perhaps more than some might want, with lots of footnotes that all of these things are solid. I want to just mention a couple of things that I think are just very telling.
Sure.
You and I have discussed on this program the role of both the FBI and the CIA in obscuring possible connections that they had with Lee Harvey Oswald and with Jack Ruby. I think it's very interesting to note, this is something I only was aware of fairly recently, when J. Edgar Hoover was called fairly late in the commission to testify to the Warren Commission, they asked him why Oswald did not take a shot. You know, the motorcade came turned a couple of times, and it was on Main Street, and it was on Houston Street, and then it did a dogleg onto Elm, which is where Kennedy was shot. And they asked, why did Oswald not take what was a clear shot on Houston Street as the car was approaching the book depository? And Hoover said, oh, there were trees in the way. Well, there were no trees in the way. And his own people had created a scale model, and he should have known that there were no trees in the way, but nobody called him on it. I think that's just amazing, although everything about the story is amazing. Now, the other thing I wanted to point out was that the FBI's own crime lab analyzed the Zapruder film, and they concluded that the first shot came while JFK was actually passing a tree, a real tree, in front of the book depository on Elm Street, when it would have been impossible for Oswald to have hit him. So these things themselves, just two, you know, one or two things like that, would have changed the entire story and would have changed history if anybody on the commission had spoken out.
Oswald was caught in a theater, and was he acting weird when they arrested him, Russ?
You know, that whole story that he drew people's attention is very, very suspicious. The behavior of the man in a nearby shoe store says that Oswald was behaving suspicious. Many of the stories connected to the people who were at the box office at the theater, you know, and then there are those eyewitness claims that there was another man, another Oswald, somebody who looked very, very similar, that one was downstairs and one was upstairs in the balcony, that one of the men was taken out the front door and the other was taken out of the back door, driven somewhere in a squad car and then released. All of this stuff is indicative of much, much more going on there.
I think so, too. Next up, Jim in Birmingham, Alabama. Jim, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. George, I'm with you, buddy. I know exactly where I was. I was 14 years old, sitting in high school when it was announced Kennedy had been,
yep, me too,
been shot. But George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, maybe he can't remember where he was, but who was he working for at the time? Another point I have for Russ is, does he know of any transcripts or video of the interrogation of Oswald behind closed doors after he was taken by the police department?
Well, as to the first question on George H.W. Bush, we know quite a lot about what he was doing and who he was working for in the book Family of Secrets. I get into that extensively. About a third of the book is particularly on that topic, so won't go into too much detail here other than to say that I discovered in my research that George H.W. Bush was not only brought in as an outsider to be the CIA director in 1976, but that in fact he had been working with the CIA, for the CIA, for many, many years undercover while a congressman, diplomat, an oil man, which is what he was doing in 1963, and that the day that he can't remember where he was, in fact, he was in Dallas. So that's all there. As to the other question, what was that again?
Let's move, Jim. Let's get back to you. Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, I'm sorry, George. Yeah, were there any transcripts and/or video?
Oh, yes.
Of the interrogation.
Right. This is fascinating because you would think that when you have the alleged assassin of the President of the United States, that you would want to make a record of it. They claim that they did not tape the interviews with him, and they claim that they have no notes. Quite astonishing, but then in this story, nothing really is too astonishing.
All right, thanks, Jim. Appreciate your question. Let's go next. Roland is in El Dorado Hills, California. Roland, go ahead.
Well, hi. It's so enjoyable and nice to be able to talk to you two gentlemen.
Thank you.
I have a few questions with the scenario that he's laying out here. First of all, I have the advantage of being able to watch a lot of television, and practically everything that he's saying on the History Channel and on the American Heroes Channel, they've had show after show after show that just puts everything that he says just out of the question, that this guy that you have as a host here or a guest is just not correct about any of it. And Oswald, he snuck out the front door. They got video of that. The policeman there said that he heard the shots coming from that building. He was like on a motorcycle cop. It's all on TV. I've seen it many times. Oswald took a bus and a taxi cab to get home, went and got his gun, and then he went and a cop was looking for him, and that's when he shot the cop. And then he went into the theater, and he snuck in the theater because there was a lady standing out front, and she was, like, trying to get people to come in or whatever, and she looked, and he was there, and the next minute he wasn't there, and that's when he snuck in. And then, so he was suspicious, and he wouldn't have shot that cop unless he knew there was something up. And I agree that they probably were looking for him fairly quickly, and that's a little bit suspicious. But then he did bring that gun into the building, and he did have that picture taken of him with that gun, and he did buy that gun that was found up on the sixth floor, and the cop says that's where he heard the shots coming from. And in the excitement of shooting, if there's a tree there, I mean, you got to get, what do you have, like 7 seconds or something to get three shots off? Sure, there might be a tree in the way. He's just trying to shoot where he can. He might, maybe there was a tree there. But they proved on TV that was easily, you could make those shots easily.
Okay, see, that was, Roland, that was just one of many shows that said that, but there were equally shows that said that he was a patsy, that he didn't act alone. And it was numerous. Yeah, somebody bought a gun named A. Heidel. I don't know who that was, Russ.
Well, look, you know, this caller just epitomized why I do the work that I do. He said that he knew what the truth was because he watched other shows. And the whole point I'm trying to get across is that the American establishment, including the very shows that this man is taking his information from, are providing false information. Almost every single point there can be disputed. The photo of Oswald with the rifle, photo experts say that photo was doctored, that was not actually Oswald holding that rifle and that newspaper. We can go point by point by point on these things. There are serious doubts whether it was Oswald who shot Officer Tippett, because Oswald has been timed to be at another location far from there just minutes before, and it's not clear how he possibly could have gotten there. Some of the eyewitnesses said that the man who shot Tippett looked nothing like him. So it is very important that we don't say, I don't believe one set of investigative research because I heard something else somewhere else. That just doesn't make any sense. And the whole purpose of what I do, what the other researchers do, and what you do on Coast to Coast is to challenge the conventional wisdom, because we know that the conventional wisdom has been lying to us throughout this thing.
Have we, with new technology, have we done a voice stress analysis lie detector on Oswald saying, I'm a patsy? That would be interesting.
It certainly would be interesting. I don't know if it has been done, but there is a general sense that at that particular point, this man had no reason to lie, because the official story is that he wanted to shoot Kennedy because he was a guy who was a misfit who wanted to be recognized by the world. Well, if you want to be recognized by the world, then you say, yes, I did it, and I'm proud that I did it. You don't say, I'm a patsy.
Yeah, you don't deny it. Sandy in Utah, let's go to, no, it's Benita in Sandy, Utah. Hi, Benita, go ahead.
Hi, George, how are you?
Good.
Listen, I'm a criminal justice student, and I've been following the stuff about the Kennedy assassination since I was 16 years old, and I am 42. The last year, I wrote a 27-page paper on the JFK assassination, and I have to say, George, that this whole Oswald doing it thing, no, I'm not buying it. I never bought it. In fact, there were some books that I got from the University of Utah Law Library that I used for my paper, and in these books, one of them had some mob people interviewed or maybe interrogated, and when they confessed to having something to do with the JFK assassination, they were killed.
Well, there were a lot of witnesses that surely died, that's for sure.
And there were mob witnesses. I mean, honestly, and the Zapruder film, I wish I pulled up the paper. I have it on an external hard drive, but the Zapruder film, it's been doctored a few times. There's been a few versions of the Zapruder film. In fact, the original Zapruder film, he did not originally want to give to the government. There was a big fight about it, actually. And the Zapruder film has been doctored a few times. So it's really hard to know which one is actually accurate.
Has it been doctored, Russ?
There are allegations that has been doctored. I am not certain at this point whether I think that it was doctored. The key point is this: it doesn't even matter really initially whether it was doctored. What matters is that that film was used. It was locked up by a news organization, which is very strange. They didn't want to show it. They took stills from it, and they put it in a magazine, and the stills were all used to sort of settle the national conversation, to establish, quote-unquote, what happened. We know that Life magazine, around the time of the Warren Commission report, they put out another issue with the photos. They had the photos in the wrong order, suggesting that Kennedy's head went violently forward with the final shot, when in fact it went violently backward. That has been proven, that those photos were done in the wrong order. Now, I've spoken to people who worked at Time Life, and there is a sense that that could never have happened accidentally. And it's important to note that the editorial director, publisher of Time Life at that point, C.D. Jackson, was an intelligence asset, very, very close to Alan Dulles. So all of this stuff ends up being circular. And I just have to say that I would caution people, not everybody that you hear talking about this is equal. You have to try to figure out whether that person is genuinely interested in investigating these things, or is putting out the same old story again and again. But when you drill down into these things, you find that all these institutions are connected. Major outfits like Time Life, Henry Luce and his wife were very, very anti-Kennedy, involved in financing their own raids into Cuba, unauthorized raids that had been forbidden by the Kennedy administration. So there's a whole important backstory to even what we learned from the very magazines that we trusted.
Next up, let's grab one or two more calls as the clock is ticking. Peter in Lexington, South Carolina now. Peter, go ahead.
Yes, let me make three quick points. The first one is, it doesn't matter whether Oswald shot Kennedy or not. I don't think he did. He could not have known that the motorcade was going to go by that building and then get a job in it way ahead of time. That's what people never talk about, is that they focus on the ballistics and all this. It doesn't matter. Oswald couldn't have changed the parade route. He could not have gotten the motorcade to go by the very building that he got a job in. The second thing is this. There was a man, a Corsican man, that lived in Marseille, France, who was a drug dealer. He was brought into Mexico City by the mafia, driven up to Brownsville, Texas, stayed in the South safe house for a day. He was on the grassy knoll with a movie camera, but that movie camera was actually a gun. It had been designed by the CIA to kill Castro. That was the killing blow. His MO was making these exploding shells. Okay, if you notice, his head explodes. It doesn't. I'm a hunter. When you shoot into things, it doesn't matter whether it's a pumpkin or a head, they don't explode. It goes in, maybe out the back. The head exploded, and they found shrapnel and gunpowder on the floor of the vehicle, which, in other words, contradicts the magic bullet theory. If these are full metal jacket bullets, then why did one bullet stay undeformed and the other, and then there was shrapnel at the bottom? It was from the exploding shell. And there's actually a photograph of a guy ducking and this movie camera that had been designed by the CIA to kill Castro. It looked like a camera, but it was a gun. that was the killing blow. On the, he wasn't behind a fence or anything. He was right there out in front. He stayed there. They paid him in heroin. They flew him to Montreal, and he went back to France. That was the killer. So it had actually been a product of Operation Mongoose, which Robert Kennedy had run out of the back of the White House, with the CIA using the mafia to kill Castro. And that's why it looked like such a conspiracy, because RFK actually was involved in some of the cover-up of getting rid of witnesses and whatnot, because he didn't want people to find out about Operation Mongoose. And I'll add a quick other little thing. Diem in Vietnam was assassinated just a little bit before Kennedy, and there was an assassination attempt on Kennedy about a week or so before it in Florida.
That's right. There were
so,
several.
Hello?
There were several attempts.
Yeah, and so my mother knows the doctor that was actually at Park Lane Hospital when Kennedy was brought in. He was supposed to do the autopsy. And he saw Kennedy's head. He saw him with his own eyes, and he told my mother that it was the blow came from the front. It could not have come from the back. And, you know, so no one talks about these things about DM and all that.
Right, yeah, well, very quickly, because we're just about out of time. First of all, he is correct that the issue of how Oswald happened to know to get a job in that building is very, very important. There's a whole section in Family of Secrets on that about Ruth Hain, who she really was, her family connections to the CIA, how she steered Oswald to that job in that building, indicating, I believe, some kind of foreknowledge that was where that was going to happen. There are a lot of things about the Corsican and about various weapons that may have been used. As far as the shots, the two doctors at the first press conference stated unambiguously that the shots came from the front. They were later told by the FBI that they were mistaken. They were told rather aggressively, and they revised their comments.
Rush, thanks for being on the program. Fascinating subject matter, isn't it?
I certainly think it's interesting. Well worth continuing to dig into.
Russ Baker, thank you so much for being on the program. Good luck with your upcoming work. Look, we normally do our Kennedy program around November 22nd, and we will, but this is the 50th anniversary of the Warren Commission. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Dowell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.